Hi, everybody. Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the TeachNet podcast. Today, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Catherine Kennedy, founder of Consult for Ed Group and host of the Edu Cafe podcast. Catherine has spent over two decades working across digital learning, systems innovation, and educator well-being, helping schools and organizations rethink how education works in practice. I first worked with Catherine about 8 years ago when we commenced work on the Department of Education's Gaeilte eHub project, and she advised us on resources, approaches to inform our pedagogical approaches. This was informed by her work as Assistant Director of the Michigan Virtual Learning Research Institute. And in today's podcast, we will chat about Catherine's current work in the areas of systemic change, personalized learning, and teacher well-being. So Catherine, after all that, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful and honored to be here.
Well, we're even more honored to have you. So, I mean, you were very helpful to John and I. It's nearly 8 years ago now, would you believe? And I think you had just finished that part of your journey in Michigan in the Virtual Learning Research Institute. So tell us what you've been doing. What are you working on at the moment? And we'll unpack them as we go.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah, I cannot believe it has been 8 years. So as Michael mentioned, I am an education consultant. I'm also a researcher and evaluator and podcast host. So I've had my Consult for Ed Group firm for about 8 years now, ever since Michael and I have been friends. And before that, I was a research director at two nonprofits, as well as professor of educational technology at several universities. And our consulting firm, the work that we're doing currently, really our team collaborates with schools and districts and states, communities, educational organizations, and companies to really support the needs of the people within those spaces in really human-centered, authentic, innovative, and meaningful ways. Our big buckets of work include really a variety of things, but they kind of fit into a few buckets. First is research and evaluation. Another is curriculum development and instructional design. And then another area, which we'll talk about today, is that we support educator well-being. And it's particularly around somatic wellness, educator sustainability, and really trying to create cultures that are places for care and really setting up associated conditions within that space where teachers and school leaders can thrive. And the EDU Cafe podcast that Michael mentioned, I facilitate conversations and invite guests on to be guest hosts if they want to on a variety of topics, all different areas of education. And the main reason for that podcast is to really offer a place for educators to share the important work that they're doing.
Yeah. And obviously, you're based in the United States. You're on the East Coast. It's the afternoon here. And I drove back from the west of Ireland, where I was in the school this morning. And I had the pleasure of listening to one of the Edu Cafe podcasts. And we will put the link in the show notes afterwards. But, you know, when we were chatting beforehand, you said to me, look, Michael, there's kind of three areas, really, and they're all interconnected. That's the systemic change, which, again, an area I'm involved in myself, and personalized learning and teacher well-being. So maybe unpack those for us, Catherine.
Yeah, for sure. The systemic change specifically, I think, is kind of that broader, more all-encompassing challenges that we're facing in our education system in the U.S. specifically. And obviously, kind of the elephant in the room, if you would like to say that, is the current administration, which has been putting a lot of pressure on the education system to the point of dismantling it. And really, schools and districts and the nonprofit organizations that are trying to support the schools and districts and the educators and students and communities that surround them and work within them, it's really been a hard time. And so what this systemic change is really focused on is what are those things that are challenging our education systems? One, right now, because of, again, the current administration, the case in point was over the summer, we had a number of different projects. And in addition to other people who we've heard of had other projects, and schools and districts were waiting for their funding specifically around professional learning, and they didn't get it in time and therefore had to cancel all of their summer learning time. And so that was what they're trying to do now, is really trying to diversify their funding structures in order to best support the organizations or the people that they serve. And so that's one thing that's happening right now that I think is hard. And I think because of that funding structure, you have things like staffing shortages, retention challenges. We even have a lot of schools that are physically closing. And then what ends up happening is obviously they consolidate and have overloads of class sizes and staff having to support multiple classes because of educators who burn out. There's teacher exhaustion, initiative fatigue, as you know, like so many different things that the government is asking them to work on, and just not enough time to actually implement all of the things. And then you have leadership fatigue. I do a bit of coaching here and there with educational leaders, and one of the things that they often have to reschedule for is because they're covering their educator classes because there's not enough people to sub in. I think you also have mental health concern, not only within the student population, but then also in the educator population. And this, you know, was pre-COVID, but I think a lot happened over COVID that really perpetuated that, the mental health spaces, because as you know, we were in a crisis and we didn't have the time to actually work through that healing process. So we're seeing the residual effects of that now. And I think too, again, coming back around to that administration piece, is you have educators of color and culture, as well as educators who identify in the LGBTQIA+ space. And unfortunately, they are being discriminated against. So they really can't show up in a safe space to be able to express themselves in the way that they want to. There's also a lot of censorship happening in the schools. And so there is a lot of unsafety, not only for the educators, but then also that trickles down to students who identify as students of color and culture, as well as students in the LGBTQIA+ space too. And so I think all of that to say, you do have pockets of hope and of sustainability in these system level spaces. And I can give you some examples of that.
So, Catherine, that's very interesting. And if I was to be honest, a little bit depressing. I mean, teaching is hard enough but to be dealing with that. I mean, I'm conscious that many of the people who are listening to us may not be familiar with the education systems and the way they work in the United States of America. And what you were referencing there was the federal government and their role in education. Do you want to give us a quick explain to people how that worked previously and how it's working at the moment?
I'm not too well versed in the funding structures per se, but I know that certain parts of the funding come directly from the federal government. And so each year, those funds typically come in the summertime ahead of the new school year starting. But it also covers the funds that are necessary to do the professional learning that a lot of schools and districts use the summertime for, because there's a little bit more space rather than throughout the school year. And so because of that shift and also holding of funds or even cancellation of funds, that was really disruptive over the summer.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And particularly in a climate of a lot of change at the moment, I mean, globally, our schools are experiencing lots of issues. You mentioned COVID. The dropout rates are quite high in many countries. I don't know if that phenomenon you're seeing in the United States. We have this thing called AI, which one of my colleagues in the University of Nantes refers to as an unwelcome guest, because it's upsetting all sorts of, you know, approaches and rituals that we had developed over many, many years. So I'm just wondering, like, what are the areas that teachers were looking for professional learning in? And you were about to tell us some good stories of how they've managed to be creative in this moment of crisis.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think for professional learning specifically over the summers, there's a number of different instructional approaches. AI has definitely been one of those big topics, especially given the nature of how it's being used in the classroom now. And also, if it is banned, I know we talked a little bit about this ahead of time, but that idea of complete bans happening in some schools and districts. But I do err on the side, not just because I'm a technology positive person, but it's also because I do believe in literacy before banning outright, because technology is going to be there no matter what, and students are going to have to learn how to use it. And so, you know, one of the things I really advocate for is more so the technology literacy rather than the complete ban of technology, because we can't solely blame technology for all of the things. It can sometimes be, as we know, as technology people, it can be used as a scapegoat for other systemic issues that are happening more widely. I think some of the hope that I see right now in schools and districts is that there is that sense of flexing the hope muscle. Given everything that is happening, it is a lot. At the same time, there are points of hope, such as finding ways around the current administration's saying, like, you can't use words like wellness, you can't use words like social emotional learning in some states, in which case what ends up happening is states are now using Portrait of a Graduate as a way around this idea of not using social emotional learning, not using wellness. And you have competencies within the Portrait of a Graduate, such as empathy, collaboration, communication, all of these things that you typically see in a structure around wellness or the emphasis around wellness and social emotional learning are similar to what's happening in portraits. So there are workarounds that are happening in state by state. And I think the other thing is this idea of finding safety or safe enough in community. And this kind of dovetails into that idea of educator well-being, or just well-being in general, is community is a place of healing. And also relationships are a place for healing. And so really kind of building those cultures of care, I think, within the systems. And that really kind of gets at the systemic change piece.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think, you know, again, it shows the resilience, again, a word that's often overused, of educators, education systems, I suppose, not miss the chance to take advantage of a crisis, which this is, to really redefine and to go after what is important and valuable to them. I mean, I know you've been doing a lot of work on personalized learning. And just to tell our listeners, when we were chatting about this at the outset, I thought you were going to be talking about the learners. But you, when you're using that term, you were actually talking about it in the context of the teachers or the educators. So tell me a bit about that, because I think that's a really interesting piece. Because again, this morning I was in a school and we were talking about AI and we were talking about what kind of supports they believe that they require. And they said training. Okay, well, I might have said professional learning, but anyway, they said training. And I pushed them for, well, what do you want? And I'm curious to hear what you might mean by this, and then I'll tell you what they wanted at the end. So over to you.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, because oftentimes the professional learning is often kind of a one-size-fits-all type of approach, and everybody gets the same thing. And I think that one of the really enlightening things that came out of one of our more recent research and evaluation projects, and this was in the states of Ohio and Nevada, and through the work that we were doing with Knowledge Works, which is a nonprofit here in the states. And they are very much focused on competency-based and personalized learning. And one of the things came out of the conversations that I was having, I'm a qualitative researcher, just for the background around it. I do a lot of the interviews and focus groups with the different groups that we're working with. And so I talked to a lot of the educators and school leaders and district leaders. And one of the things that came out of it, while we were talking about, Michael, to your point, the students' personalized learning, you know, experiences, one of the things that came out of was the personalized learning that the educators received and how they really appreciated being able to really choose your own adventure. If you're a fan of choose your own adventure books, it's that kind of an approach. It's like, here I am. This is what my goals are. These are the types of things that I would really like to learn. rather than, again, that one-size-fits-all approach to the professional learning space. And so it was kind of a byproduct of what we really were looking for, was this idea of how this personalized professional learning really reinvigorated these educators who were just coming out of the COVID pandemic, who had really just kind of lost all sense of, I do not want to be a teacher anymore. And then all of a sudden they were like, wow, this is so empowering. It kind of brings back that sense of agency and engagement with the educators. And they really can put together a pathway that works best for them from point A to point B, where they wanted to get to. So it was really exciting to see that coming out of it, even though, again, that wasn't really the point of the research, but it was definitely a byproduct of it.
Well, I mean, I think that's really interesting. Again, this morning, that was what these teachers on the West Coast of Ireland are looking for. They said, please do not give us a one-size-fits-all. There were some people in the group who were very proficient. They were using these tools, and others, actually, they were all quite proficient, but they had different contexts. So, you know, some of them were in a leadership role, others were in a support role with colleagues, and they wanted to choose their own adventure. That's what they were telling me. And hopefully that's something that can be taken on board. And I mean, I'm also thinking, as you are telling us this, like, we talk about teachers as professionals, right? I often wonder if we really believe it, though. And we have, you know, here in Ireland, we have a thing called the Teaching Council, which is, it's the professional body for teachers. And the idea of all of this is kind of based on this notion of a professional. And what you're describing is, I hear trust. We're trusting the professionals that they are the ones who are going to decide what path they're going to go down, what areas they want, all of these things. But all too often, right across the board, I hear it everywhere I go, that the models, let's call it that, or the approaches to teacher professional learning is a one-size-fits-all. It's kind of, this is it. If you can't, we say here, like it or lump it. Is this what you've been experiencing up till now?
Yeah, I feel like there are pockets of change happening, I think. And I mean, to your point, I think that is one of the biggest things, I think, that came out of the pandemic, because educators, I think, got a really bad rap over the time of the pandemic. And as you and I both know, as online learning, you know, researchers and experts, you can't learn how to teach online in a meaningful way over a weekend. And so a lot of pressure was put on educators in general at that point. But there was a lot of pressure before that, and people not seeing educators as professionals. And I think more and more there is this sense of educator as professional in the general public. But I think it did go down a really bad route over the pandemic. I think to your point about the still the one size fits all, I think we're in this kind of cycle of doing, rather than rethinking the model. And I'm not saying that all places are like that. I think there are, again, pockets of places that are doing this more personalized professional learning, but I think it's something that's growing over time. And I think educators are feeling empowered to say, look, why are you wasting my time with X, Y, or Z one size fits all thing when I could be really personalizing what I want? And I think for groups like ours, which we do a lot of curriculum development and things like that for professional learning, similar to your group, I think one of the ways that of organizations are kind of hitting this, or even schools and districts and states in general, and maybe even countries, is that they're creating these modules or like modularized learning that are specific to topics that educators are interested in. And then to the point of choosing your own adventure, you can kind of put together that pathway, all of these different modules that make sense for what you want out of your professional learning experience.
Yeah. And again, this morning when I was driving down to this school, I was listening to a book that I had bought quite a long time ago, but I didn't read it. It's Justin Reich, who's down in MIT, called Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. And I was listening to him, and he was talking about, you know, some of the things that haven't worked in learning for teachers and everyone else. things like MOOCs, but then he was talking about connected MOOCs and, you know, making that, you know, and peer learning and how that was working and actually how some of the best impact came from peer learning using connected MOOCs, but that they were a little bit just still too complex. And I suppose I was thinking about this, and I have been thinking about this myself for a while. I'm also reading another book at the moment. It's called How People Learn by Nick Shackleton-Jones. And again, they're trying to figure out, because like you, I think the model of teacher professional learning is broken. I think it needs to be rethought. And I'm just curious, do you see any other approaches that are working? You know, you've talked about the autonomy piece, the teacher agency piece. How are districts or maybe states or I don't know who's doing this, cities, going about this to make it more engaging, to make it more meaningful? I think meaningful, purpose. We keep talking about purpose. What's happening there? And that maybe, again, going back to comparative education, we might even borrow from and take over here and, you know, play around with ourselves.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple of examples in addition to the ones that I mentioned before, but like that idea of modularization. So states have created their own learning platform, and then educators can decide, you know, which particular modules make the most sense for where they are professionally. And then they automatically connect that to their professional learning CEUs that they need to have in order to kind of renew their certificates. I think the other thing that I've seen happening more so as well are these unconferences, which have been around for a while, but they are also not only that idea of choose your own adventure type, but it allows educators to kind of come together and say, where are our knowledge gaps collectively and then individually as well? And where are there some overlaps? And to your point about peer learning, how important it is for people to come together and have that time to really work with each other and to learn from each other and to empower each other in that teaching and learning process. And I think the other thing that I would say about that is oftentimes, I know our group does this, we are hired to come in to do professional learning and things like that. Oftentimes I hear that we have this knowledge within our own schools and districts. Why aren't we empowering some of the people who are experts in these areas from within to really share their knowledge, or in addition to the people that have come in, share their knowledge with our staff and faculty? And so there's, I think, a number of different things that are happening. I think there's also mentorship happening as well as coaching, which again kind of dovetails in that educator well-being piece, but it is very much more personalized than, say, you know, a professional learning that is delivered as a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah. And again, I would have seen myself that idea, the modularization. I've long spoken about the a la carte menu. We also have a term over here, pick and mix, you know, just pick them and mix them. And I think this is where we need to be going. And we have another project that we're the early stages of. It's called the Gen AI for Vet project. And we've just done some research on where people are at in terms of generative AI in the vet space. And we've also been looking at the professional learning approaches or the training approaches for the staff. And again, mentoring is going to be a key piece of it. But I'm just conscious of time. I mean, we could talk all day. This is so interesting. You mentioned teacher well-being, and I know you've published a book on this. You've done a lot of work in this, and I know your team have been at conferences and you're doing a lot. And again, I think you mentioned it in passing, and we're all dealing with this problem of losing people from the profession. You know, people who joined our profession and who, for whatever reason, are leaving, and it's a real problem globally. So talk to me about the teacher well-being work that you are doing. What does it mean to you? And how are you seeing that impact on schools and on teachers?
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I think really it comes back down to like that systemic issue. And I think that one of the things that I saw, especially over the pandemic, when it came to educator wellness and even to today, oftentimes it is considered an individual problem. The individual needs to be well in different ways and they're just not doing a good job. So it becomes this almost like shame-based approach to like, hey, you know, educator well-being, it's all your fault. Like, you need to do better on X, Y, or Z, when in reality, oftentimes it is a systemic issue and something needs to change in a systemic way or system level way. And I think the way that I see this happening or changing is a lot of organizations are rethinking, like, what can we take off educators' plate? I mentioned initiative fatigue. There are so many different programs out there that educators are having to implement, and whether it's different types of standards from various different ways and approaches. And then on top of that, everything else in terms of the programs or the technologies that they're incorporating and all of these different things. And so trying to really think through, like, what can we take off educators' plates so that they are not constantly in an overwhelmed state and completely, you know, nervous system overload, essentially. I think that's one thing. I think there's a lot of restorative practices happening, like circles where people can come together and to talk about what's working and what's not working so that they can, in a larger way, change things at the cultural level or school culture level or district culture level. I think there's also more reflective spaces, provisions of ways educators can become leaders. You know, oftentimes there aren't as many leadership opportunities, but not leadership opportunities in the traditional sense. There are other leader type roles that educators can serve in order to become empowered and do those types of leader spaces. I think giving educators voice and choice, I've seen that happening a lot more. Professional inquiry communities are different ways that schools and districts are approaching these, in which educators come to, again, the spaces with each other in community and say, here's what I'm dealing with. And it's almost like a group therapy session where it's like, oh my gosh, it's not just me. Like, you're dealing with this too. How are you working through this? And really sharing the knowledge that is already there. And then I think back to our professional learning, like that flexible learning pathways. Like, what did you call it? Something in mix?
Pick and mix.
Yes, the pick and mix approach. And then there's also like mentorship and coaching models that are happening for educator well-being. And I think really trying to focus on, again, that system level look at it rather than it being an individual issue, because it always, typically always comes back down to like, okay, our educators are not well. What are they going to do about it? Instead of, what is our system going to do about it at large in order to really support them in the space that they're in?
Yeah, like, I mean, there's so much there. I mean, I just another one for you, Catherine. You can use this. You can tell at your next conference, you can say, yeah, this crazy Irish guy. So mentoring, I call that sit by Nelly. So Nelly, think of your, you know, your Irish heritage, and, you know, Nelly could be that older person, your granny, your grandaunt. You know, and sit by Nelly. So it's that kind of, it's that caring. I mean, that's the term we use. So it's that caring. And again, thinking back, it's been a while since I've been in a classroom, but you know, you were on your own. You closed the door, you were on your own. And I like that idea about how do we collectively create spaces so that we can talk to each other, that we can care for each other. But I was thinking there when you were talking about taking things away from teachers. And again, I chatted about this with some colleagues from Australia on a podcast back in January. But Catherine, AI will do that, won't it?
That's a dangerous question.
I know it is. It's a loaded question. But like, I'm hearing people say, oh yeah, but it's great. It'll take all these things away from me. Then I'm hearing, even today, I had some teachers saying, you know, if somebody creates an AI, why would I read it? You know? So it's kind of like chicken and egg kind of thing. So maybe we should just go and take some of that stuff away anyway. Just take it away. And give the people time, proper time, so that they have time for themselves. Again, today, educator said to me, you know, we don't have time to talk to each other normally. This was great. This was a research project. But I mean, giving people time, what do you think? I mean, I'm being facetious, of course, on the AI bit, but, you know, it's the one thing that's being trotted out at the moment from an efficiency point of view.
Yeah, I would say that it's a good efficiency tool. I think, obviously, there are some privacy, student privacy, and protection type of, and data security, that kind of thing that you have to keep in mind. but it can definitely save time, say, in like writing parents back or writing, you know, general comments to community space, that type of thing. I don't know that it should be used for grading. Obviously, again, that like student privacy and all of that kind of thing. But there are things that it can definitely support. I would say, though, that a lot of the initiatives and things like that can't be taken off of educators' shoulders, and in which case it becomes more of, again, that system level decision. Like, do we really need to do 4 or 5 different things when it comes to math? Do we really have to do 5 or 6 different things when it comes to English? You know, all of these different things that are overlapping, and then also the different standards and things like that. Like, what are the have to's and what are the nice to haves? And especially with like new educators coming in, you don't want to overload them right off the bat, because then it's going to be a sink swim type of situation. And so, you know, back to what you mentioned, it's like that idea that they loved being together and being able to have that time to connect in community with. And I think, similar to the idea of like what I think about with AI, it's like all of those human-centered pieces, all of those relationship-building pieces cannot be replaced by AI. All of those things have to be done in community, in connection with humans. And so with that, I think, yes, AI can be helpful in helping to support and be more efficient and effective and really save time in places, but also there are pieces that are very important for that human-centered and relationship-focused approaches to learning and teaching.
Yeah, and I'm going to wrap it there. I mean, I think that's really interesting, that critical appraisal piece, you know, and it's having the voices of all of the stakeholders, the teachers, and I'm sure the students in there as well. But I'm also reminded, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Dylan William. He's done a lot of work in the area of formative assessment on this side of the pond. And Dylan was in the Institute of Education, and he makes the point that we need to invest in the teachers we have in the schools at the moment. You know, let's stop worrying about the new ones we want to bring in. We should think about those as well. But actually, it's the ones. And I'm just thinking, listening to you, it's invest in them and mind, M-I-N-D, mind them so that we have them and that they stay and that they're happy. I think that feeling of making a difference, which many teachers feel, we all know that if you're in a school where there is that sense of community, camaraderie, it makes life much easier to get up in the morning to go in. So that goes to leadership. It goes to another phrase that we have here, culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? So the culture, I think, is what I'm hearing from you. And that's, you're giving these schools tools to develop more resilient, more robust cultures so that they can deal with these things, these new things that are coming, like AI and other things. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And I do think too, kind of with the idea of, obviously, we have to hold people accountable and we have to, you know, assess students, we have to assess educators, that kind of thing. Yes, they are not just this one point of information. I just had Dr. Ellen Mandanak on, who does a lot with like student assessment and data policy, data privacy, and data literacy with educators. And one of the things she said is students are not one point of data. And I would say the same thing about educators as well. I do think that there are so many different things that help to make up or define what an educator is, and they are more than just their accountability or their assessments. And I think that, again, that human-centered, relationship-focused piece is going to be critical in order to keep, like you said, the educators who we currently have, especially because I see so many of them who have been there for a while and who are wonderful leaving the profession. So we definitely want to invest in that relationship-focused and human-centered approaches to supporting them.
Well, I think that's a good place to end, and it's a positive place to end, and it's a hopeful place to end. Catherine, I mean, there's so many things that you touched on during this podcast that, you know, we could go back and have another series of podcasts on. But I just want to sincerely thank you for making the time to join us today. It's been absolutely fantastic. And I look forward to talking to you in the near future. So thanks, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invite, and thank you so much for the time and great conversation.